Blog Talk Radio.
As a radio, TV, and cable mogul and owner of the Detroit Tigers, this man was a spiritual seeker and researcher, bridging the gap between science, the paranormal, and higher consciousness. And you'll be hearing much more about him from his biographer. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, licensed mental health counselor, healing through love relationship healer, somatic body psychotherapist, and health and wellness coach, helping men and women heal their bodies and their relationships through love, author of the Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me book series, the romantic novel Love in the Blizzard of Life, and creator of the Healing Through Love lessons. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter what age you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can and often does get better and better as we reach our 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. Brian C. Wilson, with a PhD in religious studies, is a professor of American religious history in the Department of Comparative Religion at Western Michigan University. After writing an award-winning book on serial inventor and the leading Seventh-day Adventist of his time, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, the Fetzer Institute invited Wilson to write a full-length spiritual biography of its founder, John E. Fetzer. He was a radio pioneer, media mogul, and longtime owner of the Detroit Tigers baseball team for more than 60 years. Fetzer also studied higher consciousness, spiritual empowerment, paranormal insights, and energy medicine long before most of us were aware of any of this, attempting to bridge the gap between science and spirituality. So it's a great pleasure that I'm welcoming you today, Brian Wilson.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. So I would love to hear about your early background. What led you to have an interest in spirituality and in writing and in doing biographies or particular biographies? So please tell us. I know you mentioned you were in the Peace Corps. I'd love to hear more about that also.
Mm-hmm. Well, originally in college, I was majoring in medical microbiology, and the idea was that I was going to go off to med school. And at a certain point, I decided that I really needed to go out and get some more experience, life experience, before I made the commitment to becoming a doctor. So I joined the Peace Corps. And this was back in the early 80s. And they sent me to Honduras for a couple of years. And then I re-upped and did another year in the Dominican Republic. And it was really a transformative experience because I was exposed to two very different cultures in Honduras and Dominican Republic. And I became really fascinated by Roman Catholicism. Both of these countries are predominantly Roman Catholic. But in Honduras, I also lived near a ruined Mayan city called Copan. So I got very interested in the Mayans and Mayan religion. And then in Dominican Republic, I lived in a town that had a large population of Haitians who were practicing voodoo. So that was very interesting. So by the end of my Peace Corps experience, I had decided not to go to medical school, but to come back to the States and basically get a PhD in religious studies and become a professor of comparative religion, which is what I've done for the last 22 years. In terms of biography, yeah. what I'm really interested in is my specialty is American religious history, and I focus on new religious movements. And I'm really fascinated by how individuals basically put together their worldviews. So that got me interested in writing biographies. And especially people like John Harvey Kellogg and John Fetzer, they both kept records of themselves, their papers, their letters, their books, all these kinds of things. And so it was easy for me to put together a very kind of rich portrait of how they basically constructed their worldview. And in most cases, with most people, of course, it's almost an unconscious process, so it's very hard to get at. But with these two gentlemen, because of the paper trail, I could write really pretty complete spiritual biographies of both.
So tell us first about John Kellogg. I know he introduced the cereal, so just talk about him a little bit.
Uh-huh. Well, he's very interesting because he is, or was, a Seventh-day Adventist. And Seventh-day Adventism is a Christian group, an apocalyptic group, that actually began as a denomination here in Michigan way back in 1863. And it had precedence before it came to Michigan, but it was here that it became an actual denomination. And one of the interesting things about Seventh-day Adventism is that they became very interested in health and maintaining good bodily health, because they believed that you could only have a healthy soul in a healthy body. And so very early on in the 19th century, they began practicing like vegetarianism and alternative medical treatments like hydrotherapy and things like that. So Dr. Kellogg, who was raised in this tradition, when he got back from medical school, they put him in charge of their institute for, it was called the Western Health Reform Institute. And he basically transformed it into the Battle Creek Sanitarium. And the sanitarium for decades, well into the 20th century, was kind of the biggest and best known health and wellness destinations in the United States, if not the world. So he had this huge reputation as an innovator in alternative health. But he's best known today because he had all these patients at his sanitarium, and he wanted, of course, for them to eat a vegetarian diet. But the foods they had for them, the vegetarian foods, were typically very, very bland, and so people didn't like them. And so Kellogg, along with his brother and wife, got together and experimented, and they invented all sorts of new food products, including the flaked cereal products, the breakfast foods. And this is the birth of Kellogg's Corn Flakes and all those other breakfast cereals. Although in the beginning, of course, the whole idea was that these would be pure. They wouldn't have salt or sugar or any additives, and they would be a good health food. So it was up to John Harvey Kellogg's brother, Will K. Kellogg, to basically break with his brother, put in the salt, put in the sugar, and mass market these things as you know, tasty food for kids.
Fascinating. I also just wanted to add a piece. I read the Blue Zones, and the Seventh-day Adventists have a large number of centenarians, people that live into older ages and remain healthy into their older years.
Yeah, I was told that when doctors do these large double-blind experiments and they want a control population, a lot of times they'll seek out Seventh-day Adventists or Mormons, because a lot of Mormons also keep to a healthy lifestyle and do tend to live something like 10 or 15 years longer than most Americans.
Okay, so let's get on to John Fetzer. And
yeah,
what were some of his early projects? Tell about his background. What led him to create the Fetzer Foundation in the 1970s and 80s?
Well, he there are kind of two parts of the story, because one part is that he got very interested in radio as a young kid and studied radio engineering. and created one of the first commercial radio stations here in Southwest Michigan. And he was based in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And he built that into a kind of media empire with not only radio, but also television and cable. And then in the 1950s, he bought into the Detroit Tigers. And by the 1960s, he became the sole owner of the Detroit Tigers. And he was an owner for almost 30 years. So he made millions off his businesses. But the thing that really interests me as a professor of comparative religion is the fact that parallel with his business life, he had this very active spiritual life as well. And this is something that a lot of people who worked with him, a lot of his business colleagues, knew very little about. And what happened was that he also was a Seventh-day Adventist. His mother had converted to Seventh-day Adventism when he was a teenager. And John Fetzer followed her into the church. And in his late 20s, he decided he wasn't being spiritually fulfilled. So he broke with the Adventists and began exploring just a wide range of alternative and metaphysical traditions. And basically kept studying these traditions until the end of his life. So he had this very interesting kind of alternative spiritual path along with this tremendously successful business career.
Well, also, being spiritual can help to improve your business career.
There's an energetic component. Yes, he definitely thought that because he believed that his intuition, his ability to make more right decisions than wrong decisions in his business, and his ability to surround himself with good people was a form of ESP, of extrasensory perception. And so he really believed that in addition to a whole lot of long hours and hard work, there was also a psychic component to his business success. But the interesting thing about this is that ultimately he was always a little bit uncomfortable with the money he made. And he always felt that there really needed to be something more than just simply making money. There had to be a mission before the money. And so that's why he basically married his spiritual life with his business life, because late in life, when he got into his 70s, and this was in the 1970s, he began to think about liquidating his businesses and creating a foundation that would perpetuate his kind of spiritual vision for the world. And he did this in the 1980s. He liquidated, sold off all his businesses. And he used that, the proceeds from that, as the endowment for what became the Fetzer Institute, which is still thriving today.
So what are some of the traditions that he studied? And you did mention he was involved with IONS, Institute of Noetic Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
So just share about that.
Sure. Well, back in the early 1930s, when he broke with Seventh-day Adventism, one of the first places he turned was he went down to Indiana and went to a spiritualist camp called Camp Chesterfield. And Camp Chesterfield, which is still in business today, is kind of a permanent psychic fair. And there he met spiritualist mediums and psychics and spiritual healers and diviners of all kinds. And he got really fascinated with all of this stuff. And Camp Chesterfield also had a really good bookstore, still does. And he said every time he went down there, he would come back with just armloads of books on all sorts of traditions like theosophy and Rosicrucianism and Hermeticism and New Thought. And it just goes on and on and on. And so throughout his life, he kept exploring these kinds of alternative metaphysical traditions. So late in life, he got interested in things like the Urantia book and A Course in Miracles. He was one of the earliest readers of the Course in Miracles after they were published, and had study groups and took the precepts of A Course in Miracles very seriously. One of his other interests was he was always interested in kind of harmonizing science and spirituality. And this went back to his early radio days when he started speculating about what's the connection between the kinds of energies that we can experience, you know, like electromagnetic radiation, like radio waves, and more subtle energies in the universe. And he came to believe that it was all connected and that the universe essentially is all spirit, which he thought of in terms of the metaphor of energy. So it's always circulating. And that there's a great central source that's basically emanating out these energies. And if you want health and happiness and enlightenment, you basically have to tune into these energies. So one of his projects was he always wanted to kind of scientifically prove the reality of spirit. And so during the 1970s, his foundation began supporting a variety of different research projects on parapsychology. So ESP and clairvoyance and psychokinesis and things like that. And at the same time, he also became one of the earliest early board members of Edgar Mitchell's IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And there was a lot of shared interests between the Fetzer Institute and IONS. And to this day, they still have a relationship and still are working together on various projects. So John Fetzer found Edgar Mitchell's experience with telepathy on the Apollo mission just absolutely fascinating. So that was the kind of thing he was very interested in exploring scientifically. But it changed over time because during the 1970s, he became rather frustrated with the pace of research in parapsychology, and his health was also failing. So in the 1980s, mm-hmm. he basically shifted to looking at holistic health and funding holistic health projects.
Well, that's interesting. He shifted. That's what happens. As you get older, the health issues pile up
yep.
from all the past emotional baggage that we have.
That's
not
right.
On the
yeah.
diet that we were talking about and the exercise, all of that. All right. So,
that's right.
But he also talks about reincarnation. So what
yes.
did Fetzer believe or understand? How did reincarnation and past lives affect the way his life?
Well, he very early on, and I think it was because of the influence of theosophy, came to believe in the reality of reincarnation and that he had lived through multiple lifetimes. And he used a variety of means, including, for example, the Ouija board and also consultation with psychics and channelers to basically trace back the history of his past lives. And he believed that he could actually trace his past lives back to the mythical island of Atlantis. And the importance of this for him was that he believed that every one of his past lives was really focused on the same mission that he was focused on in the present life, and that each one of those past lives he had learned something and had gained a certain amount of wisdom that allowed him over accumulation of many, many past lives to enter into this life and to finally implement his mission, which was essentially global spiritual transformation, successfully. So reincarnation for him was tremendously important because it gave him the confidence that perhaps in this life he could actually fulfill his mission and create an institution that would last after his death in order to basically perpetuate his spiritual vision.
Hmm. That's beautiful. So what did he feel was the spiritual meaning of wealth, since he did create tremendous wealth?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because he always said that money was energy, and energy to do work in the world. And that work could be positive or it could be negative, depending on what the kind of spiritual impulse behind it was. So for him, he lived a very frugal life. For a multimillionaire, he had a nice home, but it wasn't a palatial home. And he didn't have the chauffeured limousines or the private jets or any of the trappings of wealth we know now.
Mm-hmm.
Because he always had this idea that since money was energy and energy to work needs to circulate, it was his job to basically put this money back to work into the world to realize his spiritual vision. And so that's why near the end of his life, he systematically sold off his businesses and invested it in the endowment for the Fetzer Institute. Because otherwise, making money, it was fun and it gave you a sense of accomplishment. But he found just money making a kind of hollow activity unless it had some kind of mission behind it. It was the mission, not the money.
That's so important.
Yes.
For many of us to learn. Wow. So why did he keep his spiritual knowledge and search a secret until later in life?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for it. One, I think he was part of his personality. He was a very private person, just in terms of his character. But I think he was also concerned with, well, I know he was concerned with the fact that in West Michigan, which tends to be fairly conservative religiously, he was afraid that if people knew what he was studying, they would misunderstand it. And potentially he could lose, audience members and advertisers for his media businesses. So he tended to keep it fairly quiet. And he had a great gift of being able to compartmentalize his business life from his spiritual development. And so even some of his closest colleagues who worked with him for decades knew that he was into some interesting things, but had no idea of the depth of thought he had put into his spiritual quest. And it was only in the late 70s, when he was beginning to sell off his businesses, that he started to become much more open about his metaphysical beliefs, such that in the 80s, he was very public, or much more public than he had been in the past. Because at this point, he was putting together the Fetzer Institute and was very open about its kind of spiritual mission.
Yeah, I'm just reacting to something you're saying, thinking about what's going on the internet at the moment. There are so many people promoting different spiritual practices, and many of them making lots of money doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be doing it too soon without really having spent all those years of private study and private whatever it is, meditation, connection, getting to the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a very old-fashioned term, discernment, spiritual discernment. And I think that only comes with a great deal of study and experience and practice. So I'd be rather suspicious of somebody who, maybe picked up a book or two and then said that they knew what was truly spiritual and what was not, because that kind of discernment really only comes after, I think, decades of study and maturation.
Right, and that's what you see in someone like Fetzer.
Yes,
that
definitely.
Process. What have you personally learned from writing about both of these men, and then specifically Fetzer?
Well, what I love, John Fetzer always talked about freedom of the spirit. And what he meant by that was that everybody really has the right to chart their own spiritual path, but always with the idea that their individual spiritual transformation would somehow be part of a larger social or global spiritual transformation. So it wasn't kind of hyper-individualistic as a lot of spiritual searches are today. There was always this social component. And the same thing with John Harvey Kellogg, rather. He always did his businesses, did his alternative health, promoted the Battle Creek Sanitarium, all with this idea that there was a larger kind of social mission involved. In his case, he believed that, you needed a healthy body to have a healthy soul. So it was tremendously important for people's spiritual welfare that they also have physical purity. So for both men, what was important, even as successful as they were, what was ultimately important was this kind of larger social goal.
Hmm. So what have you discovered in your own spirituality in this process of studying about it and teaching about comparative religions?
Well, when people ask me what my religion is, I oftentimes tell them it's comparative religion, and because I kind of label myself a kind of agnostic seeker, because on the one hand, I'm just absolutely fascinated with studying this stuff and fascinated with spiritual people and their lives, but on the other hand, I'm still kind of on the road, kind of on the fence still. You know, looking for my own spiritual path, if you will. And I'm very comfortable with that because I like the idea that, I mean, it's a cliche, but it's the journey, not the destination. And my profession as a professor of comparative religion is perfect for a person like me because I get to explore just a wide range of all sorts of spiritual and religious movements. And if I teach for another 50 years, which is unlikely, but if I do, I'll never run out of new things to discover and material to teach.
And have you had any experiences, direct experience of feeling the effect of this?
Well, I've never actually had what I would characterize as psychic experience. I feel inspired by it. And I inspired by both John Harvey Kellogg and John Fetzer's stories. So I would say what I'm really inspired by is the fact that both of these men continued seeking throughout their lives. And John Fetzer, it's amazing because even into his 80s, he was reading new books and trying out new ideas and trying out new practices, new meditation practices. And he was essentially meditating up until the day he died, meditating on his deathbed. So I find that very inspiring that you can keep this kind of curiosity, this kind of seeker spirit, well throughout your life. And hopefully I'll be able to emulate that as well.
And what I'm finding useful from what you're talking about is that as a biographer writing about these people, if you haven't personally had the spiritual awakening or that experience, you're not putting your own information in there. You're really writing about what these people discovered. You're kind of out of the
way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's how I approach my teaching because I really want students, if at all possible, to kind of leave their preconceptions at the door and learn religious and spiritual traditions from the inside out. So to really get to know people of different religions or different spiritual paths, you have to really take the time to understand them. And it's difficult because we always want to judge and we're quick to criticize. But in my classes, it's really the understanding that's the important part of the process. And so you try and basically get as much as you can into the mind and spirit of the other person. And that's why doing biographies on people who are so well documented, like Fetzer and John Harvey Kellogg, is a joy because you really get a feeling that you really know kind of the contours of their spiritual life.
So tell us about your book about John Fetzer and how people can get the book and contact you?
The book is published by Wayne State University Press, and it's available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and other online booksellers. And it's available as a hardback and as an e-book, as a Kindle. And if people would like to learn more about the Fetzer Institute, there are two websites they can go to. One is called infinitepotential.com, and that's the website of a branch of the Fetzer Institute called the Memorial Trust, which is in charge of preserving the legacy of John Fetzer. And at that website, you can find out more about the Memorial Trust, and you can also download a free PDF copy of the preface and first chapter of the book. And if people are interested in learning more about the programs that the Fetzer Institute is doing, you can go to Fetzer, F-E-T-Z-E-R.org, And there you'll get in-depth descriptions of all the various kinds of spiritual programs that the Fetzer Institute is doing today.
Wonderful. Well, any suggestions that you can leave our listeners with about their own quest for spirituality?
Well, I would say keep at it, keep an open mind, keep exploring. And I think it's that openness that basically will carry us through.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Brian Wilson, for sharing your insights today.
My pleasure. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you. And I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, drericagoodstone.com. There are lots of free reports, and you can get a complimentary Healing Through Love or Love Mastery Secret session. So it's drericagoodstone.com. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon.